All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the next, last episode of the final episode of Read Rothbard podcast. This is a Martin Luther King Day special. We've got some news to let you guys know about. We're not going away by any stretch. We're just going to retire this name and remorph into something beautiful with anarchy in the name. We've also got a special guest who's going to be coming on with us in a few minutes. But first, I want to say hello to Robert. How are you doing, Robert?
Bigger, faster, and stronger. Hello, all you sexy people.
Yeah, so Robert, why don't you just allay their fears real quick and give them a rundown of what our plan here is.
Daniel's got some master final solution plan to finally spread the message of our anarchy propaganda out to more and more people to help us with searches and just generally in marketing purposes. So we are going to be switching over to the name Actual Anarchy, where we are going to still do the same thing. We're still going to be reviewing movies from a libertarian perspective, like a philosophical review type situation. You know how we do it. If you've heard any of our episodes, that's what we do. But we'll be pointing out instances of actual anarchy in the world. We'll be making a case for what we see as anarchy as opposed to the kind of social communistic view or the lefty scared statist view that it's some sort of machine gun warlord Mad Max scenario. So we'll be making a case for our free market, freedom-based peace and anarchy and love and beauty. And we'll also be wrapping things all together into some sort of a violent hierarchy, because all hierarchies are violent, Daniel.
Even the voluntary ones.
That's right. Right. And what are the names of our different heads? I'm not even sure. We've got Actual Anarchy. We still have Reed Rothbard, and then we've got Enemy of the State, which will still exist. But then we've got, what is our hierarchical overlord name?
We're going to throw everything under kind of this blanket page called Libertarian Union, but readrothbard.com will exist as its own page. Actual Anarchy will exist as its own page, and we're going to have three podcasts. So we're going to continue on with the Read Rothbard podcast, but that's going to actually be audiobooks of articles and books by Murray Rothbard. We've got Enemy of the State, which are lectures by Murray Rothbard and him actually speaking, and then Actual Anarchy is going to be what, like Robert was saying, what we already do now, where we take movies and cultural events, and talk about them from the Rothbardian and anarcho-capitalist perspective.
Boom.
Yeah, so it's going to be this whole wide, empire, this property-loving, freedom-loving, this group of individuals who just want to get the message out there of what actual anarchy is, highlighting actual events of anarchy in their lives, which, if you read that Molyneux book, 90 to 95% of your everyday interactions with other people are in a state of anarchy. And so we hope to highlight a lot of those situations and let you, even if you're not familiar with it, realize that that's how you're already living.
Yeah, it's just this tiny little part where you think that government needs to step in and do things, which isn't anarchy. But every other decision you're making in your life, whether it's to buy one brand of pasta or another, or it's whether to befriend the guy down the street or not, or which car to buy, or where to work, all these decisions are all pure anarchy, and you shouldn't be afraid of them because anarchy is nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah, indeed. I think what Robert meant to say instead of pure anarchy, he meant to say actual anarchy. We have to stay on message, right?
I don't know what you're talking about. Don't listen to that guy.
All right, so with that housekeeping aside, let's continue on with the final episode of the Read Rothbard podcast, and let's introduce our guest. I think he's probably ready by now. His name is Ryan Jones, and he blogs over at theafrolibertarian.com. Ryan and I met at the Tom Woods Elite Group on the Facebook. And if you're a fan of Tom Woods, just become one of the supporting listeners, and you'll be able to join the group. It's super awesome being in there. You don't get the whole ad hom, name calling, blocking thing going on. It's one of the only reasons I'm still on Facebook. So Ryan's a good guy who posts a lot of interesting content in there, and I knew that I wanted to reach out to him, so finally was able to. And Ryan, do we have you there?
Yes, I'm here. You hear me?
Yes, we do, sir. Yeah, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Glad to be here.
Yeah, awesome. So I'm glad that you're here as well. And, you know, Robert, we didn't even mention we're going to talk about the movie Selma. It's a Martin Luther King Day, and Selma was a big event that was a movie a couple years ago. So we're going to review that film and talk about a lot of the issues that we see coming out of that, any libertarian perspective. Ryan's here to join us for that. And before we kick it off, Ryan, you want to give us a little bit of background on you and maybe how you came to libertarian or anarchist philosophy in your own life?
Sure. I've been a libertarian for about about 8 years now, 8 or 9 years. Like most people, you know, the 2008 Ron Paul, you know, economic collapse, all that stuff kind of woke a lot of people up. I was for years, even before that, I never really fit in. I never really felt at home with the Democrats. You know, I grew up a Democrat in a Democratic household, like, you know, 95% of black folks do, you know, but I just never really fit in with Republicans and the right wing and the ultra conservatives, you know, so I was always in that, I just call myself an independent. I try to pick who's best, you know, depending on, you know, what values I had at that certain time. Then eventually, I think someone sent me the Peter Schiff Was Right video, and that just blew me away how he was able to, you know, how he pretty much predicted everything that was coming years before. And I looked him up, and, you know, on his Wikipedia, they talked about the Mises Institute and how he was the economic advisor to Ron Paul, as if he needed one. But then I was like, oh, Ron Paul, I've seen that guy around before. I remember when, you know, I was living in Baton Rouge. I used to live like two blocks from LSU. And I remember one night it was just a whole gang of kids, college kids, with these Ron Paul, vote Ron Paul signs. I'm like, whoa, who the hell is Ron Paul? You know, but it was just so exciting. They were excited, and I woke up the next morning, and they were signs everywhere, signs hanging from bridges, from buildings. I was just like, man, this Ron Paul guy, he must be popular. And I looked him up, and talking about, you know, abolishing the Fed, abolishing the IRS, abolishing the Department of Education, abolishing the EPA, abolishing the income tax. I'm like, what the hell? What did I just stumble onto? This guy's nuts, you know. But, you know, he stuck with me, and that, you know, as I read more, I found out about, you know, Milton Friedman, and I was like, whoa, he's a super libertarian. But then I found out about, you know, Murray Rothbard, and he just lit me on fire. That's when I discovered anarchism, you know, life without the state, you know, and, you know, true freedom. And, of course, that leads you down an even darker path to Tom Woods and Stefan Molyneux and, you know, Lou Rockwell and so many others, you know, the people we listen to today. So I've been here since, man, you know. And I'm, you know, I, like you said earlier, the Tom Woods elite, anybody listening, they should, you know, all you got to do is spend like at least $5 a month, and just one of the perks is being on the Tom Woods Elite Facebook. There's tons of, you know, super smart, creative people like you guys, exchanging ideas. You know, everybody's friendly with each other. We'll challenge each other. We'll argue, but it's nothing nasty. You know, it's kind of our little safe space. But, you know, I guess everybody needs a little safe space sometimes, especially out here on these internet streets. So. Yeah, that's it. I'm just here. I'm just, you know, here to chip in and see what I could offer to the conversation.
Yeah, I'm wondering if any of those, all those other Ron Paul people back in the day, did they kind of disappear? They go away? They turn into like mainstream Republicans or whatever?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if you've got other libertarian friends around in your area, because we don't really have a whole lot up here where we're at.
No, I don't have many, man. I mean, I wasn't involved in any groups or anything back then. But I mean, I worked at that time for the state of Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And just in my IT group, there were three libertarians, two of them anarchists, not including me. Like,
wow.
What are the odds, you know, working for the state government.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, those are my close friends. Even one guy, he was Indian. He was actually from India. He was an Indian immigrant. And, you know, he was a pure anarchist. You know, we pretty much went down that path together, exchanging ideas and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of us, but, I mean, you'll be surprised where we turn up.
Yeah, definitely. That is surprising. But, yeah, like, we're all exchanging information over the Internet. It's a good time to be alive.
Yeah. Can't beat it. Imagine being right for it.
Yeah. Well, back then, we were just, like, a room full of people. Like, libertarian gatherings.
Yeah, just some smoky room at, like, you know, some little hotel somewhere.
Right.
Cranking
some hotel off the interstate, just everybody getting together.
Drinking coffee, you know, this is
So, Ryan, you actually posted a little bit on your story on your blog, right, on how you came to libertarianism, and I think Robert on our pre-show call was talking about how it made him tear up a little bit.
Yeah, man. It's a good story. I like your writing. It's good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, trust me, I've had no inclination to ever blog, you know, but, you know, if you listen to Tom Woods enough, he kind of badges you into doing something, you know. You know, I just said, hell with it. I'm going to start a blog, just get my ideas out. I don't have much content on there yet. It's just because I don't have much time, but, you know, one day I'm going to fill that puppy up with a bunch of posts, you know, because I do have a lot of things that float in my mind that I just want to get off my chest, you know, and do my own Rothbard thing. Because that's really what was great about Rothbard, is all the, you know, scholarly work he did. You know, I just love his articles because, you know, people like to look back at his articles now and judge certain things he said, but, man, he was just getting it off his chest. Whatever it was somebody maybe pissed him off that day, and he just went in, you know, just went in that day on his typewriter, you know, dropping 12 pages, and he put it out there, you know.
He'd lay him out, too, man.
Lay him out.
Knock the fuck out.
Yeah, I was just reading one of his old posts he did on Malcolm X, you know, and it was kind of on Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. But he rarely talked about Martin Luther King. He just didn't like Martin Luther King. I don't know what it was about MLK, but Rothbard just didn't like him. He kind of liked Malcolm X. He liked some things about him, but it's just funny just reading how he talked because, I mean, it was, you know, it wouldn't be allowed today. I mean, it's so anti-PC, but I love it, you know.
Yeah, well, maybe we can bring up some of that Rothbard stuff that you were reading later on, because I'd be curious to hear. I haven't read what he had to say about those guys at all.
That's good stuff.
So, Robert, let's have you do your thing here, where you talk about the plot of the movie, Selma, and then we can start talking about some of the issues.
All right, so this is my breakdown, at least my plot synopsis. So Selma, directed by Ava DuVernay, came out in 2014, and it stars David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King. And the movie starts with death threats, calls to the MLK homestead, and this is something that is repeated throughout the movie. They were constantly getting death threats from who knows who, but probably KKK and other people. And they, not only death threats, but also they would get messages of recordings of supposed MLK infidelity to Floretta. But anyway, the movie kind of starts with the church bombing, where four young girls were murdered at the Birmingham, Alabama, 16th Street Baptist Church. And then it goes to a scene where Oprah, I don't know the character she's playing, but she's trying to register to vote in, I assume, Selma, because she appears later in Selma. And the vote register guy is like being completely ridiculous about it. And he's saying, you know, she's filled out this document to the letter, and then he asks her to recite the preamble to the Constitution. And then when she does that, he asks her how many judges are in, like, Alabama court districts or something like that. And apparently her answer isn't good enough, and so he says rejected.
Yeah, he says there's 68, but name them.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so she gets the number right, and then he says name them. So, you know, total dick move, right?
Right. So then there's a scene with, I believe MLK is talking to LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who's the current president at the time. And they start off by mentioning that they repealed the segregation laws, because this is taking place after the Civil Rights Act. This is actually all about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So they're talking about how they repealed the segregation laws. Shouldn't you be happy? And MLK is like, no, this isn't good enough. We need this voting law. And LBJ is like, well, my actual deal is like this war on poverty. I'm really ramping it up. This is going to be sweet. This is going to be my deal. So kind of get in line sort of a thing. And King is like, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. So then Martin Luther King and his kind of group that he travels with, that they all kind of work together, they go to Selma. And he gets to town, and he, like, signs in to, like, the hotel he's going to stay at or whatever. And, like, this guy comes up to him and says, can I introduce myself to you? And King's like, sure. And the guy just assaults him, just attacks him and punches him in the face.
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed earlier in the film when they were first showing Selma after his arrival, it says whites only, and it has the hotel name. So he was trying to check into a hotel that was a whites only hotel.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Okay. So then there's a scene where the FBI chief is talking to LBJ, and he offers to murder Martin Luther King to get him to go away permanently.
Yeah, wink, wink, right? He actually did wink in the movie.
Right, and Johnson's like, no, that's not going to be necessary. I want this guy. I want this nonviolent guy leading this. I don't want any of these militant people to do it, take over. So then the next kind of big scene is King leading this protest in front of the courthouse where Oprah tried to register to vote. So he's leading this group, and they all go up, and there's these troopers and the sheriff standing in front of the courthouse, and there's all these people, and they sit down in front of the courthouse, and the sheriff is like, you need to clear out of here. And they're like, well, we're here to register to vote. And they're like, there's too many of you. And they're like, we'll wait. We can get in there. It's fine. And so then they, the troopers kind of like start assaulting everybody. And they end up arresting a lot of people along with MLK. So then MLK's in the jail with a bunch of other people. Malcolm X at this point shows up and he offers to help. He's like, I'll be the option that they don't want. So then they'll go to you to be the option that they do want. King is hesitant. He doesn't really like Malcolm X. He doesn't like his style. So then we kind of move on to this night march. King had gone off to Los Angeles to do some fundraising, and there's this night march. And it's not clear whose idea this was, but he wasn't there. And the idea was to, I don't know, march in the middle of the night without light, with very few cameras. And the government actors kind of took this as a good idea to beat some people up and to really intimidate people. So there's all the cops show up, and they got all their billy clubs, and they start assaulting everybody. And we follow a little family of three. There's an older man, a young man, and a young woman. And they try and hide out in a restaurant. And three troopers bust in and start assaulting them, and then they murder the young man. Then MLK comes back and he says, like, you know, there's no words to kind of comfort the man in his grieving of his dead son. And we move on to MLK making this speech in front of this church congregation, where it's a strange speech. It was a strange speech for me to watch, because on the one hand, he's saying very strange things where he says, everyone is guilty. That's not standing against this thing. And then he says that they want to take the power and vote the men responsible for the murder out of office. Then they move on to this march, where they're marching kind of from Selma to Birmingham. And King isn't there. I forget if King is in the jail or if he's just away. But there's all these people walking north, or walking from Selma to Birmingham, and they're crossing this bridge. And there's all these troopers lined up at the end of the side of the bridge, and they're saying, you know, you need to disperse. And one of the leader guys is like, let me talk to you. And they're like, no, there won't be any talking. And then they put gas masks on, and they start just assaulting everybody, firing tear gas, and just brutalizing people. Or, you know, walking. So then there's a news reporter who's kind of reporting what's happening, and he's saying that there were white people on the sidelines who were whooping and cheering as people were being assaulted. Then Martin Luther King comes back and talks to the press. He says that all people bear a responsibility to their fellow man, that all men are created equal. Those are just some of the highlights that I noticed, but he's basically trying to drum up support for his cause. Then he himself leads another march to Montgomery, and this time the troopers move aside. And then when they move aside, MLK turns around, and he claims that it could have been a trap. So then later on, I'm sorry, this is kind of rambling and whatever, but a bunch of people, he made a call for action, and all these people came from around the country to show their support. And while they're in town, this priest from Boston is murdered in the street. So then they have this court battle to decide whether or not they're allowed to go on this protest, which kind of rubbed me the wrong way. They wanted to get some judge's approval about whether or not they should be able to walk on this road or not. And then at the end, they do end up going on this march, and then the movie ends with a speech at the end by Martin Luther King, and I've got issues with a lot of it, and I feel mixed feelings. The anarchist in me kind of recoils at a lot of the begging the state to treat them better, but at the same time, you know, it's hard to criticize somebody who was in the trenches at the time doing the best they could. So that's kind of my breakdown of the movie, but I've got a lot of points and different scenes to talk about. So, Daniel, if you want to go ahead.
Yeah, well, Ryan, do you have anything to start talking about at this point?
Oh, well, I mean, it's been probably a year since I saw the movie, so it's not super fresh in my mind. But some things did stand out to me. The conversation with Malcolm X that he had with Coretta Scott and him, you know, before everything went down. I never read anything about that. I don't know if that was true, if it really happened or not. But I just thought that was interesting because during that time, that was when, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were viewed as kind of, not enemies, but two opposite sides of the, you know, of the pole, you know. So I thought that kind of meeting was interesting. I don't know if it happened or not, but if it did, I don't know, it's pretty interesting. And, you know, that tactic Malcolm X takes where, hey, I'm going to scare them so much to where they'll come to you, you know.
I just
thought that's pretty ill, you know, that's sick. But sick in a good way. Well, not good way, but just, you know, that's just pretty tactical, you know. So.
Yeah, I remember. There was some controversy on how historically accurate the film was or not. And I don't, you know, like you were saying, I don't know if that conversation actually happened, but it is interesting in that it's rather Hegelian, where they're taking this thesis-antithesis and making a synthesis. You know, like they're saying, all right, Malcolm X is going to play bad cop and MLK can be the good cop. So he'll be so, you know, bitter a pill for them to swallow that they will come running to support MLK just so they can avoid having what Malcolm X represents, which is a more of a aggressive resistance versus MLK's total nonviolence.
Exactly. And, I mean, you could argue, you know, from a libertarian standpoint, you know, Malcolm X, he wasn't a libertarian by any means, but Malcolm X probably was speaking our language more than Martin Luther King. But
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah, but my mom would tell me stories. Malcolm X would scare the heck out of people, you know. They just didn't want to hear that type of stuff, you know, but he was just a nationalist, you know. We hear it now a lot, but, you know, just like Farrakhan, but he was a very, very great communicator, and he was a nationalist. He wanted black separation, you know. So, and that was just different to hear, especially from someone so confident in themselves, you know. So, I mean, it was interesting. Just the dichotomy between those two was always fascinated me, and to see which one worked, you know. Obviously, Martin Luther King, his strategy worked better, you know, even though both of them ended up dead by whoever, you know. Speaking of that, I don't know if you want to go on a side note, but do you guys think Martin Luther King was killed just by that random I don't even remember his name anymore, but just the one-man shooter, or was it, do you think there was something more to it?
Yeah. The conspiracy theorist in me and just the realist, I think, in me says there had to be something behind it. I mean, I forget the exact nature of the guy, but it was kind of some kind of career criminal guy who, like, didn't care if he went back to jail forever or not.
Right.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it was just some lone guy.
We're talking about J. Edgar Hoover, you know? I mean, come on. And they had people watching King 24/7. So even if it was, like, some guy, like, they at least knew what was coming, you know? But, you know.
It's always a lone nut, right? And Rothbard talks about it in one of his lectures. I'll try to find which one and post it below. But, yeah, it's always, like, one crazy guy. And I think that's just a tool of, you know, like in Zoolander, it's always, they're always a model, right?
Yeah, like right. Sirhan, when he killed Bobby Kennedy, I mean, he didn't even know what he was doing. Yeah, JFK, all these, it's always a lone nut that's been played up or used in some way. There's no way it was just one guy that wanted to do it, and so he did it. It's possible, but
it's
not probable.
But, you know, it's one of those things. We'll probably never, ever know the truth, just like, you know, JFK, but it's just something, you know. But, yeah, other than that, you know, with the movie, I just thought, it was a pretty good movie. You know, it didn't really, you know, flame any emotions like those movies typically do, but mm-hmm. It was overall good, and I thought the director, Ava, whatever.
Right.
I thought the director, she did a good job. You know, she tried to include everything she could. You know, obviously she probably took some, you know, some liberations with the storytelling, but, you know, she included the bombing, you know, the terrorist attack, if you want to call it, you know, the church, mm-hmm. You know, which, I mean, literally, that's a terrorist attack, in my opinion. That was, you know, that's crazy. But, you know, all that, just imagine all that going on at that time. You know, I mean, the tension, that would just, I just can't imagine it now. Well, I mean, I can imagine it now because, you know, we do pretty much have that, but.
Well, there was all that, especially with all the, I mean, just another point to say that it was probably some kind of conspiracy to kill him. I know there was a lot of, wasn't it MLK who was saying, and they were afraid of him saying that, you know, to tell all the black people not to go fight in Vietnam?
Yeah, that was later. Yeah, later before he died, in about 67, he became very outspoken against, you know, foreign policy, the war in Vietnam. He became he sounded like a libertarian. He was like, bring them back home. We don't need to be over there. Period. Not just black, but everybody, Americans. We don't need to be over there. And that, I think that really set the fuel. I think the government was okay with him with the kind of racial unrest type of thing. You start talking mm-hmm. against the military-industrial contract.
Right, they can't have that.
Oh, no, we got to shut this guy up, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened to Muhammad Ali, right? He was like, I got no quarrel with the Vietnamese, and they stripped his title, put him in jail, right?
Shut him down. Like, can you imagine that happening today? Like,
yeah.
Think of, like, the most popular athlete, I don't know, LeBron James, you know. Imagine them kicking him out the NBA, stripping his rings. I mean, that would just be unheard of, but, like, it happened in America, you know?
Yeah.
This is crazy stuff. And over not over race, but over the, you know, the military, the foreign policy, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, I think these days it wouldn't be the government. It would be the leftists, like, trying to get them to get torn down, right? Because he violated their safe space and didn't say something that was politically correct or something.
Good observation. It's pretty much the same thing, you know? They do it without the violence of the state, but they pretty much... It's almost like the state, you know, where it's just this mob rule that just shuts you down and you can't even get up, you know. But as far as the rest of the movie, I enjoyed it. They included the two white liberal people that came down to march that eventually got killed. You know, you don't hear about much about them, like in history books. They were like these like liberal socialists, you know, that marched with Martin Luther King. You know, I just think of Bernie Sanders. I bet Bernie Sanders was one of those types, you know. This is out there marching with Martin Luther King, you know. But they eventually got killed by the KKK, one of which, of course, was a FBI informant, you know. And they tried to slander the female, make her look like she was hanging around with Negroes, and they tried to put, like, syringe marks on her arm to make it look like she was, like, a drug addict or something. But come to find out, that was just dirty tricks by the FBI. So, I mean, most likely they had something to do with killing her, you know. So,
it's
just crazy, the times, when you think about it, you know. And I'm sure we like to think times have changed. Maybe the intentions have changed, but the tactics they took, I'm sure they still use, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost too bad that Bernie wasn't down there, right?
I ain't going to say it. I'm not going to say it.
Hey, man, we wanted some controversy on this show.
All right, man. Bernie gets it right like 1 out of 100 times.
Yeah, he'll say something true. And then he'll,
completely blow it away. 5 seconds later, he just really shits on it, you know.
Yeah, he held the bass-ackwards response to it. You know, it's funny. I knew I wanted to do this movie for a show for MLK for this holiday, but I hadn't seen it yet until a couple of days ago, and I was dreading watching it because I had this total expectation that it was going to be this SJW socialist tinge to it, and I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, it was actually a very well-done movie, but not too strong of that message I was expecting. Though to your point, Ryan, I do agree. I think that it was a movie that just kind of happened, and it didn't draw on a lot of emotions, which was a little bit strange because it was a very emotional story that they were telling. And I felt like they didn't really... I felt like after watching that movie, and it's 2 hours, I expect to have the main character, MLK, get developed a bit. And he's in it a lot, but I don't know if I learned a whole lot about him from it.
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't feel any strong emotion from it at all. You know, I was just like, oh. Like, it was just basically a good historical documentary. That's how I would look at it. Like, wow, that happened, and moved on. But, yeah, I thought, the guy did a good job as MLK, but I didn't feel like, I guess they just didn't deliver the emotional impact I was expecting. You know, I mean, because they haven't been, to say MLK is like this huge figure, there really hadn't been like a lot of MLK movies, Like, Malcolm X, the movies by Spike Lee is like one of my favorite, top 20 movies of all time. Like, it, anytime it's on, I watch it. I didn't get that impact from this movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie since it came out, and I remember it's super long, right? It's like 3 hours or something. But
oh yeah, it's long as hell.
I remember being pretty impacted by it, and I think that came out when I was in high school. But yeah, the only MLK experience I had was what you see in the media, and I think I read a book about him in third grade. One thing I did see in recent years was. Steph Molyneux, he does a lot of the truth abouts and, whatever subject or whoever. And he did one on MLK. And in the movie, they talk about how the government was trying to paint him with a socialist brush to discredit him. And I think that Steph talks about a lot of the Communist Party socialist tinge to some of the things he was saying. And I don't know if I know enough about it to really say much. But do you, either one of you guys, see any of that in what he talks about? I mean, his idea of equality based on the content of your character, I'm all with that. That's totally fine. I support that entirely. But do you think that there was any egalitarianism in what he was talking about?
Want me to go?
Sure, you go for it.
Yeah, definitely there was egalitarianism. There was, one of his main mentors was Gandhi, And, especially if you look at the history of socialism in America, post-World War One, a lot of the Jewish folks started immigrating to America. A lot of times they would end up in the black sections of cities, And these people, they talked to each other. And a lot of these, Jewish folks that came over, they were socialists, they were communists, And they, there was a movement. If you look up Trotsky and what he wanted to do, he wanted to tap into that, that inequality, into that rage that was building within, the black community with the whole civil rights and with the Jim Crow, with all the things that were going on. He wanted to tap into that. He didn't know how. He couldn't really figure out how, but they did. And they were on the college campuses just like today, A lot of the socialists that are around today, like Betty Wright, they came up in the 50s going to Berkeley, and having their professors, socialists, talking to them about Cuba and how great Cuba is and how great the Soviet Union is and all that stuff. That, the socialists are all about equality and welcome everybody. And America is this great evil empire that wants to stomp you down, these capitalist pigs. And, this fed into the anger, So, a lot of it is rooted in some socialist. I don't know if MLK was a socialist. He hung around with many. He hung around. That's what kind of put him on the radar of J. Edgar Hoover. He was hanging around with all these Communist Party people and stuff like that. So that, it wouldn't surprise me that some of his motivations came from that, but if you look at what he was saying, he really wasn't he wasn't that extreme. He was just more, you know, hey, we're all the same deep down. And, you know, he did, you know, towards the end of his, before he died, he did kind of get more radical on the economic end. But there's some believe that he was kind of pushed. That was kind of like a trade-off with LBJ. He was like, you know, okay, I'm going to be against the war, but I'm going to help you out on this war on poverty thing. You know, so he started preaching more about economic equality and, you know, redistribution of income and stuff like that. So a lot of people like to say that's why he was eventually assassinated, you know, because he was becoming woke. You know, he was becoming more of a true socialist instead of this kind of a, you know, of a half measure.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting you use that term woke, because that seems to be a present-day term that a lot of folks will use who are, I don't know, I'd categorize them as like urban white hipsters, you know, to be like sensitive to racial issues or transgender issues or whatever they consider themselves woke. And isn't it one of the things that was sort of attacked in that MTV Hey White Guys video, New Year's Resolutions? I think you just watched it recently, right?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
No, it's funny. I mean, I just watched it. I remember when it came out, and I was just like, I just saw what it was about. Like, dear white people on MTV, I didn't even have to see it to know what they were going to say. I was just like, oh, this is stupid.
Right.
But then I watched it today, and it's just so stupid, man. I mean, what are you supposed to say? You know, I mean, I'm not a white guy, so I don't know how it feels, but I can imagine how it feels. It's like, Jesus, like, leave me alone, you know? What did I do? You know, but it's so stupid. I mean, they talk about woke. You know, woke was, especially around the time of, like, Trayvon Martin and, you know, kind of the early days of Black Lives Matter. You know, it was always about stay woke. You know, they would post something about, you know, African history or, you know, what's going on in the world, black people, and stay woke. That's the hashtag, stay woke. You know, that kind of became that kind of a thing, and I guess it kind of migrated to the suburban white hipsters, you know. So now they're like, whoa, I'm woke, you know. So I don't know. It's just funny they included that. They tried to make it funny, but I just thought that TV thing was just dumb. Like it was. It actually looked like something like Julie Borowski or something like that. Like she'll make fun of SJWs, you know. Like that's how stupid it looked.
Yeah,
and Julie's great, but yeah, she sometimes wears a like crazy costume and does weird stuff. I think she actually did a response to this. So did Mr. Dapperton, who used to be known as Anarchy Ball. And I think his point was, well, what if we made it about black people or Mexican people? You know, it would be like totally outrageous, and you'd get shut down completely.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's not even arguable. See, you know, a lot of people like to make those points. Tom Woods, everybody. What if we did this about blacks? Or what if we did this about Muslims or something? I mean, it's not even a question, you know. I mean, you got to understand you're viewed as the master race, the top dog. So, you know, we can make fun of the top dog, but the top dog cannot make fun of us, you know. It's like the prettiest girl in school making fun of the fat, ugly girl, you know.
So, Brian, there's a truth, a nugget of truth to the only white people can be racist thing?
No, I'm not saying there's truth to it, but I'm just saying that you could, I'm not even going to say you can understand where they're coming from, but that's where they're coming from with it. Like, that's
right.
That's the area they're coming from. Like, if you're the prettiest girl in school, you can't talk about the ugly, fat, ugly girl. You know, you'd be like, oh, you're just mean. But if the fat, ugly girl does a nice riff on a pretty girl, it's like, oh, go ahead, girl, you got yours in. You know, you're standing up for yourself, you know, which I find kind of condescending. You know, I don't like that either way. You know, you got to, you know, especially when you look at it on the bigger picture, we're all just people. Like, we're all just individuals trying to make you know, you're living your life, I'm living mine. There's no real grading level to, you know, who's winning, you know, and who's not, you know. So that's right. Obviously a construct that they came up with, you know. But that's where they come from it. That's the way they're coming at it. It's like, oh, you guys have all the power, so we could say what we want, you know. You can't be racist, you know. We can't be racist, you know, because you have all the power. You're the richest, you have everything, you know, so.
Yeah, and that whole, that power argument seems to be very socialist in my mind, because it's this nebulous thing, right? It's like, what power in what respect?
Yeah, and not to mention the fact you're lumping all white people together as some sort of giant group, when we're all individuals, like you said.
I mean, these same people probably 20 years ago were saying, oh, don't generalize, you shouldn't generalize. Now they're just making these huge generalizations. I mean, you could just be, I mean, if you're just a middle-class white guy Not even that. If you're a working poor white guy, you're still like this privileged guy that just has everything handed to him.
Or even an unemployed novel writing white guy with 2% of propane, which Robert is right now.
Good. Super privileged.
You're privileged, man. You're privileged.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm feeling it. I'm feeling it. Let me tell you.
Sorry to break it to you, buddy.
So, hey, before we get off this MTV thing real quick, one of the other arguments that they presented was that saying you have a black friend doesn't mean anything or isn't good enough or something along those lines. And I take issue with that because I think that by default, if you have black friends and you aren't racist against black people, I mean, you are judging people by the content of your character. But, Ryan, you're going to tear me apart on this one.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, Dylan Roof, his good friend was a black guy. You can look him up on YouTube. Like the media were interviewing him, and they were like, "Yeah, we talked the day before he went and walked into a church and killed 8 people because they were black." You know, that I think, like for me, I have a low grading level for, I mean, a high grading level for racism. You know, you have to really prove you're racist for me to call you racist. I think that's pretty racist. You know, let's go find this black church and shoot everybody in there while they're praying. You know, so yeah, you could be racist and have, you know, a black friend, but and it also goes back to what you define racism as. You know, they define racism as, I mean, saying, "Yeah, I don't think affirmative action is a good policy." Like that's racist to them. You know, so so they have a pretty low bar of defining racism. You know, so yeah, you could have, but me personally, I mean, I think it's limited. I think if you're truly a racist, I mean, you had white people in the South, you know, way back, you know, they had black friends. You know, they. Some of their slaves were good friends to them. You know, they were like, "Hey, that's my boy. You know, I take care of him every day, but that's his slave." You know, there's still a level of racism in that. But, I mean, it's all, I guess, in how much you want to break it down, you know. But, like I said, I can't sit and judge anybody. You have to look at the context of what they're saying and how they're living before you judge them as racist. And personally, I just don't have time to sit here and judge people. Are they racist or not? I just don't have the time or the mental energy to, like, think about that stuff, you know? I used to when I was younger, when I was brought up on those type of thoughts. Like, "Oh, I bet that guy's racist," you know? And I remember I was working at the hospital, and I was trying to move up, you know, in advance, you know, move up in advancement into the IT department. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys that worked in the IT department, he was a black guy, he was like, "Oh, yeah, they're racist up there. You know, good luck trying to get up there. It's full of racism," you know. And I believed them. I was like, "Oh, okay, that's why they're not answering my applications." And I told my sister about it because she has, you know, she was pretty high up in the, you know, in the organization. And she was like, "Just stop it. You know, there's no racism." You know, she said, "You keep doing your work. You finish school. You know, somebody's going to give you a call. Maybe not us, but somebody. It's nothing to do with racism." You know, and she kind of slapped me in the face and kind of got me right, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the economic argument is if you can do the job, and if there was racism, then your wages would have been depressed in contrast to somebody who wasn't. So you would have made them more profit by fulfilling the same level of work. You know, so there's a free market incentive to get the best person regardless of race or whatever else. I mean, the best person who can do the job, male, female, white, black, alien, you know, 3 legs, 5 arms, whatever, it doesn't matter.
And this happened, you know, this happened in history. You know, people... You know, businessmen tried to hire black people, you know, but then there will be this, you know, the unions will come out against hiring blacks, or they, you know, they'll partner up and try to get some politician to inspire some kind of anger, or they'll use some kind of dirty tricks. They always go back to, you know, black men are trying to rape white women. They always, you know, they'll bring up all these fears, you know, and then to try to, you know, to tamp it down, you know. But it's the, you know, these black socialists, you know, and these, you know, these Marxists today, they, well, for the last 50 years, they like to paint capitalism as this an institution of racism, which is like the complete opposite. It's like the furthest you can get away from racism is capitalism, in my opinion, anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, though it certainly, in true capitalism, voluntary situations, it certainly allows for racism to occur. Like, right. You should be free to associate or not associate with people on any reason, you know, any choice that you make.
Yeah. And but that's not racism to me.
You'll just suffer a market disadvantage because of it.
Yeah, but, you know, association, you know, choosing who you associate with isn't necessarily racist to me, you know. I mean, it might be prejudice depending on, you know, the reasons. You know, if you think, you know, all white people are evil, or all black people are evil, you know, so you just choose to stay away from them, Well, that, I mean, I guess that's kind of racist, but that's just more prejudice to me. Like, I don't care. I don't, those people don't bother me. Like, they don't want to be around me. Why would I not? Why would I want to be around them? They're doing me a favor by staying away from me. But it's once they start trying to use the state. You know, speaking of that, you guys brought a great point. I think it was on the Star Trek episode where you said voting, I don't know how you said it, but voting kind of socializes the violence. You know, it spreads it out. It lowers the cost of violence.
Yep.
So while, you know, in a free society, you might have a black neighbor, some black guy moves in your neighborhood, and you don't like black people. You know, for you to get that black person out of there, you're going to have to implement some, you know, pretty expensive resources. You're going to have to get a crew together to run them away. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to put your life at risk to run somebody
That's right.
out of a neighborhood, you know. But, hey, with the government at hand, all you got to do is go cast a vote. You know, all you got to do is send $100 to a politician and call them every day, you know, to get them on your side, you know. So, that, I mean, to me, so when it comes down to a racism, I think it was Malcolm X, that, I mean, Martin Luther King that said it, you know, prejudice plus power is racism, you know, and I look at power as the state, you know. So if you're prejudiced and you have the state on your side, that's true racism, you know. But you remove the state out of it, you get some prejudiced people. That's just gonna have, that's just a part of the earth. You know, maybe we can move past it one day. You know, we haven't yet, but I could deal with that as long as I have my freedom to, you know, trade and associate with who I want to and, you know, live my life.
Yeah, it's funny how in the film Selma, they're sort of begging the state to, you know, grant them the right to vote, and it's sort of the state that's been oppressing them. And I guess from a leftist perspective, they would be arguing that they're good actors and bad actors within the state. So some of them, you know, like Governor Wallace and the head of the police troopers and the sheriff were, you know, bad agents of the state, but LBJ was, you know, neutral to good, and a couple of the other folks were good or protagonists within the film. So they would probably lay the argument out that, well, the state is a representation of the will of the people, and because the will of the people only allowed white people to vote, therefore the will was racist, and the government was therefore racist. So if we just get the right people in power and we allow black people to vote, then that'll solve the problem. It sort of rubbed me the wrong way because, you know, here they are begging their masters, if you will, for some privilege that, you know, in my mind is actually an aggression against others voting. And I don't know, it just seemed like, I almost, like you were saying earlier, Malcolm X was more of the libertarian in that he wouldn't stand for that shit.
And he would have, right. He just wanted to, like, separate, which is, you know, people, lefties, like, shriek and cry about it, like Brexit and that sort of thing. But
yeah.
Freedom of association is inherent to all people, and if you don't want to hang out with somebody, and if groups want to get together and not hang out with other groups, they should be perfectly free to do that. So, yeah, I'm all for it. Any kind of increasing compartmentalization or complete, you know, people want to separate and go about and do their own thing, make their own groups. That doesn't hurt me at all.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand where, you know, in the civil rights movement where they were coming from, because, like you said, voting is sort of an aggressive act, although a very minimal one, a very minimal aggressive act. You know, collectively, it's a very harsh aggressive act. You know, but that
right.
aggressive act has been taking place against, you know, blacks at that time. So obviously they would say, hey, you know, let's use this to our advantage. Let's try to, you know, at least even the scale a bit. And if you, I don't know who gave this lecture, but it was on the Liberty Classroom, Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. You know, he said, the lecturer said, the most changes came after the Voting Rights Act. Because before the Voting Rights Act, they had already passed legislation to for public accommodations, I believe, you know, so businesses could no longer do, you know, colors only, I believe. You know, I don't know if that was before or afterwards, but I think he said after the Voting Rights Act was passed, that's when all the changes really happened, because people, I guess, you know, people really got scared, like, wow, you know, the scales have been kind of even now, you know. But like you said, I mean, voting is just another form of violence, you know, that's all it is at the end of the day, you know, so I don't know. For me, from a historical perspective, I can't say I dislike it, because obviously I've had some benefits from that. You know, I don't. You know, I could walk wherever I want. I don't have to deal with sundown towns like they used to have all over America, where if you're black and you're out at night after 7 o'clock, you know, you can get your ass beat, you can get killed, you can get put in prison just for being out. You know, there was a curfew. You know, black people had to buy this guide. Like this traveling guide, there's a special traveling guide where to avoid. Like, don't go to this town. Don't take this road. And it was somebody put together a guide that lets you travel all over America so you can avoid these sundown towns and these aggressive towns where black people just happen to disappear, you know. But they look at a free market at work, you know.
Yeah, free market response to that.
Yeah, but, you know, so, I mean, it was just a crazy time. So I kind of, I don't say I excuse them, but you kind of can understand where they were coming from at that time. But at the same time, I completely agree. You're going to your masters to beg you. You pretty much beg them to just oppress us a little less.
Right.
Or oppress them more so we can mm-hmm. get even. You know, it's at the end of the day, just overthrow your oppressor or don't acknowledge him as an authority anymore. Say, hey, you're no longer my authority. You know, and look, some black people tried that going back to the 1800s. There's a guy, I don't remember his name, but he tried to, you know, get like a movement of all these black people from the slave states to move to Kansas and form their own little city or state, you know, but it just didn't get traction because you've always had liberals and people that kind of wanted to push this whole, let's all live together in this egalitarian society, which, I mean, just from from a human standpoint, just has never really been natural to come about. Well, I won't say it hadn't been natural. It just hadn't come about yet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
it's fairly tribal. In essence.
Right.
But yeah,
it is what it is. You know, it's nothing racist or bad about that. It just becomes racist once you institute the state to start committing violence for you. I always like what Walter Williams said. He said, if they had to pass a law for it, that means people already wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, just like in the 1600s, there were, you know, the blacks that did get free from slavery for whatever reason, the free people of color, you know, sometimes they would date white people and get married to white people. For some people, that was appalling. So they passed these laws to ban interracial marriage. You know, the state came in after the fact to put down a law to prevent people, free people, from doing what they want to do.
Yeah, that's where marriage licenses came from.
Exactly. So it's always the state that comes in after the fact to prevent people from making associations that they wanted to, you know. And that's not to say that there weren't free people committing violence, but you could, you know, put them in jail, you know. If, you know, if white people are burning down, you know, black neighborhoods, put them in jail. If vice versa, put them in jail, you know. But don't, you know, it's only the state comes in and, you know, it's choosy in how they react, you know, how they put their violence into play.
Yeah.
Right. And the government provides such a terrible service. I mean, if you're talking about how the government is essentially a company that's supposed to provide laws and order and whatever service to a certain geographical area, that all the laws you scribble down on pieces of paper are supposed to apply equally to all, and then they don't actually do that, you're providing a bad service. And from the libertarian perspective, well, since they have no competition, of course they're going to provide just the worst, shittiest service. Right. They have little market incentive to provide a good service. And Martin Luther King, you know, he made it such a big issue that essentially he had to force and basically basically give any prospective action a lot of political capital to achieve what he was trying to get done, if I'm making sense here.
No, I see what you're saying.
He had to make it such an issue to grant these government politicians enough political capital to take it on. So in that sense, it was quite clever. I mean, what he did, I think, was, I mean, to achieve his goal, to get government to actually do their jobs as they claim that they have the right to do, it was actually quite well done. I don't know if we want to get into this, but because it's kind of like Monday morning quarterbacking style, but did you have any issue with how MLK kind of wanted violence to happen? He wanted his protesters to get attacked by the cops. Like, there's a scene on the bridge where he goes and he's on the march to Montgomery, and then the cops kind of go away, and then so he turns them all around. And it seemed to be that he later said that, well, there was probably going to be a trap. But it seemed to me that he needed there to be violence because he wanted there to be a lot of attention on it. He wanted, you know, in order to be an oppressed person, you needed to have an oppressor. But in order to achieve his goal, he was willing to, like, sacrifice some pawns, so to speak. Do you have any kind of issues with that, either of you? Kind of like a Machiavellian ends justify the means kind of a thing. I generally think of MLK as a good dude, but it seems kind of a strange, like a general will sacrifice, you know, and make a feint with like 500 troops knowing that they're going to die in order to win the battle. Anyone want to jump in on this one?
Yeah. From what I've read, that was, you know, that was the truth. I don't know if it was like, you know, a strategic thing or, you know, just a spur of the moment. Hey, you know, let me just get the best out of this situation. But
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it you know, that there was some truth to that. He knew if he could show that the civil rights group, his group, the SPLLC, showing that they're nonviolent, they're not the ones aggressing.
Right.
And show the other people, hey, these are the aggressors. We're the ones being beat down in the street. That would reach out to just the normal middle class white voters out there in, you know, all around America, the ones up north, the ones out west. You know, that would hit home with them. That would, you know, that would, you know, create sympathy. You know, and that sympathy, you know, sympathy turns out votes, you know, works.
Right. You know,
so he was strategic. He was a very smart man. He was strategic in looking at the long view, and he was very, people criticized him for it, but he was a incrementalist. You know, he had no, you know, a lot of, like, they showed the student groups that he was with, you know, that was behind him, like,
right,
all these little college student groups. They wanted it now. They wanted everything they wanted it right now. He was like, hold on, you know, we have to do this smart, get a piece at a time, you know, we can't win the whole war, it's going to be battles. So that's how he looked at it. He and that's how the left is today. They still take it today, like, you know, incrementalism. You know, I always say, like, the left, if you hate them for what they want, they're great at getting what they want in small pieces and being happy with it, you know. Like, even if it's just Obamacare, like, that's, like, how can you call yourself a socialist and like Obamacare? Like, it's even from a socialist standpoint, it's a terrible law, you know, but, you know, hey, it's the best we could do now, and eventually, hey, maybe we'll get single payer health care. You know, where us libertarians, we like, you know, screw that, you know, destroy the state, burn it all down. You know, But I mean, myself, I just can't. It's hard for me to talk myself into being like an incrementalist like that. You know, but I mean, liberals have no principle at all, so I don't think it's too hard for them. You know. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a lesson that we as libertarians can take from this. I mean, not the whole begging from the state, but like that longer view where you're strategically, because, I mean, they obviously could have defended themselves, but they would have been overwhelmed, right? So sometimes self-defense isn't the best option, the course of action.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. If MLK brought guys with guns out there and they started shooting at the cops, I mean, it's over. You know, we wouldn't even be talking about the civil rights movement, right? It would be like the civil rights terrorist group. You know, it'll be completely different on how we look at history. So, you know, I mean, you could say what he did was right or wrong, but, I mean, it worked, you know. So.
Yeah, and there was a scene early on where MLK had taken that very strategic path and said, hey, we can concentrate just on this courthouse where we're going to try to all register to vote. It's very concentrated, and we can get a lot of press coverage on it. But when Sheriff Clark goes into the crowd and starts pushing that old man who can't kneel down or whatever that, you know, they want him to do or get out of the way, the Oprah character, she hits the sheriff. And
yeah,
I was wondering,
right,
if you guys thought she was justified in doing so, and I think definitely she's coming to the aid of another. But it is a contrast to the MLK approach of nonviolence, because, like, even though she had the right, the moral right to defend another and defend herself,
right,
strategically it wasn't going to get her anywhere other than beat up and in jail.
You know, this is why I always say the state loves MLK. That's why we have a MLK Day. That's why, I don't care if you're Republican, well, even though Republicans came out against the MLK Day for the most part back in the day, I mean, a lot of them at least, especially on a local level. But, I mean, over time, MLK has been that darling, you know, because they love the nonviolent approach to, you know, to protesting and not recognizing authority. They like that approach. They could deal with that. We can take the, you know, we can give you a little crumb here and a little crumb there to keep you satisfied. They
right.
don't want the Malcolm X, the Black Panther, they don't want to deal with that because that's blood in the streets. You know, that doesn't look good. Because, I mean, when you think about it, as strong as government is, we love to talk about the power of the state. It is very powerful. It is. But, I mean, if you watch, like, the riots in Baltimore, like, they pretty much took over half the city. I'm talking about, like, 300 people. Over half the city. I mean, the police department were out. They were done. They didn't know what to do. So when you think about it, like, if you know, the American people wanted to start a revolution, it wouldn't take many. You know, Don't get me wrong, the government has a lot of weapons and a lot of guns that could blow people away, but if just enough rose up, you know, that scares the hell out of the state. You know, that's why they would rather pass some laws, spread some money around, you know, just to keep you peace, just to keep you at ease, give you some crumbs so you're not going hungry. You know, that's why they'd rather take that approach to ruling rather than using the heavy hammer, you know.
That's
once you come, yeah, once you come down with the hammer, that really incites a rebel, you know, a rebel group that will, you know, try to take you down, you know.
So that was kind of King's whole strategy. Yeah, show them for the thugs what they are. That was kind of King's strategy, right, to get it in the news and make it just so obvious and apparent. Though I want to contrast a little bit, Ryan, with what you're saying, because I think in a lot of more recent protests and riots that have occurred, that there have been instigators, like implanted instigators who try to start shit, and I think it's been argued that they're government agents, like provocateurs.
COINTELPRO is absolutely a real thing.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't know if they're government or if they're like Soros agents, you know.
Same thing.
Same thing, you know, I mean, I don't know, but I mean, I've seen it. I know people that were out there in Baton Rouge during the whole protest, you know, and it always starts out with just normal people from the neighborhood, you know, just coming out and trying to vent their spirits out, you know. But then after a day or two, you know, once it gets online, you have all these little groups, all these little political action groups that get money from Soros and all these different places. They come down and D-Ray, he was down here. Everybody was down here. Then it becomes this big media scene. You know, and I always laugh at, do you guys know who D-Ray is, the Black Lives Matter guy?
D-Ray Nicholson.
Is he the guy who said he got hit by the car at the in St. Louis or whatever?
I don't know, but he's the guy. Him and Sean King, they always used to kind of tweet together. And he's a black guy. He's part of Black Lives Matter. But anyway, he was down here, and there's a picture of him being arrested. And I mean, it's like straight out of a magazine. He's like standing there, sweaty, looking dead into the camera. You know, he's skinny. You know, and he looks like a model. You know, and he's being arrested by these big SWAT police, and it's the perfect picture of state versus man, you know. Mm. But he was just using the same old Martin Luther King tactic of, hey, let me try to engender some kind of sympathy to show, hey, we're the weak being, you know, beat down by the masters, you know. Which on some level I like, but on another level, I don't like I know what they're trying to do, and I don't like where it's headed, you know.
Yeah, well, that was the Gandhi thing, right? Like, some of the, what was it, the salt march that they did where they just walked into all the British just beating the crap out of them and they just kept walking into it?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because, like, King had been through a couple of, in Selma anyway, they talk about how he'd been in Albany or somewhere up in New York and then another city where they're dealing with different types of sheriffs or police officers who either made mistakes or didn't. And so it made him conceive of this strategy to, like, concentrate their efforts in one area and deal with a police, antagonist who would definitely overreact and become the bully, which, you know, I'd argue from a libertarian and anarcho-capitalist perspective, they're all always bullies, no matter what. But obviously he would become more of an aggressive bully. And I don't know, not to go sideways on this too much, but I kind of felt like, you know, the whole time I was watching this movie, I'm like, well, isn't government the problem? And here he is, like, trying to get government to, like, be the solution, and it just seemed kind of weird to me.
That's been my whole gripe, like, literally for years. I was like, why are we asking them for salvation? You know, would the slave go to his master and beg him, you know, be nicer to me, you know? Maybe they would, you know, but to me, it would be more like, you know, I have to set myself free, you know, I have to take my life into my own hands and figure out a way to free myself, you know, from this bondage, you know?
Right, because when you beg your master, you're just legitimizing the fact that they think that they're your master. I mean, you should just be, you have no authority over me. I'm walking away from you.
Right.
And if you come at me, I'm taking you down. I mean, it's easier said than done. I understand that, but
right. And you just hit the point on it. I mean, it's easier said than done. So I guess at some level, they're taking the easiest, you know, the easiest route to what they're trying to get, you know.
Right.
Even that's not really easy, but it's easier than just, you know, say, getting a gun and saying, okay, I no longer recognize your authority, Mr. Sheriff. I mean, he would blow you away.
Yeah, and that's like the Oprah character hitting back, right? Like, it's not a strategic decision. The second march that they did where the troopers all stood aside because there were enough people there, that's when the rabbis were there and the priests were there and a bunch of white people and black people, like, the group was much bigger than the first attempted march across the bridge. And it reminded me of Larkin Rose and his YouTube video, The Tiny Dot, because it really showed how many more of us there are than there are of government agents. So, like, to your point earlier, Ryan, you were saying that they're scared to shitless of MLK types, or sorry, Malcolm X types or Black Panther types, like, actually resisting and becoming a large enough, yet still small in relation to the entire population, but a large enough group to actually resist, how small in relation the government actually is to the overall population.
Exactly my point, you know. I mean, that's why I've always argued when people, you know, Black Lives Matter folks talk to me, hey, you know, what should we do, you know, because I always be like, you know, man, you're just legitimizing the state, you know. What I'm always asking, what are your goals? Like, what's your long-term goal, this Black Lives Matter thing? Because they can't give me an answer. They'd be like, oh, we just want freedom from the police. We don't want to be killed anymore. I'm like, okay, well, you're not telling me anything, you know. And I always suggest, what if your neighborhood, say it's a, you know, it's a majority black neighborhood, what if all you guys come together? You know, you could use the state apparatus if you want. You could say, hey, we're going to come together and we're going to sign these petitions to say we are going to separate. We're going to become our own town. We no longer recognize this district police force or this parish or county police force as our authority. We no longer accept it. We're going to form our own. You know, and I don't know if there's some kind of legal method you go through for that, some kind of like city nullification or city secession. I don't know if it's possible. Maybe you form your own state. I don't know. But why not take that route instead of just standing in the street, screaming through a bullhorn until somebody beats on you and you can get on camera and then tweet about it. You know, I mean, what are we trying to do here, you know?
Yeah, Ryan, I'll say, if you do start that sovereign area, I will move there.
You sure? I'm serious, though. I mean, if that's what you really want, if you're literally legitimately sick of police occupying your neighborhood, your territory, kick them out, you know? Kick them out. There were police, you know, they are, I mean, I won't say they're underfunded, but, you know, those guys just want to go home. Those guys just want to come to work, go home to their wives and kids at the end of the day. They're not trying to fight a revolution, you know? So if you come out strong enough, you could kick them out. And they'll be like, hey, okay, we don't want to build your neighborhood anymore either. And they'll move on. You know, maybe not, I don't know. But that would be a strategy I would take if I was like, CEO of Black Lives Matter or something.
I like it. I think you're right. Cops don't want more work to do. And if you come in and say, hey, this is our own thing, this is our own area, you don't need to come here anymore, we're going to do for us, and we'll have our own, offer up like a business to provide like policing-type activities for this area.
Yeah.
You know, I see that'd be an attractive thing.
That police department, his crime rate might go look better, you know? We're excluding this whole part of town. You know, our stats
right.
Don't look that bad now, hey.
Right, yeah, our crime rate went way down.
Isn't that what happened in Detroit, you know, when they went bankrupt and couldn't afford to pay for, you know, police and maintenance and schools and all that? Didn't some private services come up and provide that instead of the police?
Yeah, I only know about the guy that Tom Woods interviewed. He has his own little private security thing where, you know, he mainly services, you know, high-income folks, you know, businesses and high-income people. But he makes so much money from that, he's able to kind of subsidize the low-income section of their work so they could, you know, police some of the low-income neighborhoods and stuff like that. I mean, I look at it, it's interesting stuff. It's hard for me to find anything about them, like, in the news or anything like that. So I do kind of question it, like, hey, is this real? Because it's so unbelievable. Even though it's what we preach, it's still so unbelievable, you know, for that.
Yeah.
You know, so, but, I mean, I don't see why it wouldn't work, you know. Because if you think about it, we ask the police to do so much, you know. Well, not we, but the state asks the police to do so much. All these laws. Think about all, you know, millions of laws that they have to enforce. Like, what if they only had to deal with property crime, you know, assault, murder, you know, rape, you know, all that stuff, violent acts.
Yeah.
Like, what? Just those like 10 or 15 things. That's all they had to worry about. Think how much time they would have on their job. But instead, they had to worry about, is the guy jaywalking? You know, is he going 6 miles over the speed limit? you know, did, you know, let me get my quota. So let's start a DWI checkpoint. Take 20 police cars, put them in this area, and just jack people up to see if they have updated insurance or an updated license.
Is the funny thing with that is that's government trying to act like a business. They're trying to generate revenue.
That's all they're doing, man. I mean, they just started this thing down here in New Orleans where they take these dummy cars and they put the camera on there, the speeding light camera, and they just park them all over the neighborhoods just to try to catch people going 5 miles over the speed limit. Like, that's just stealing money to me. Like, it's literally just, I'm stealing your money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Imagine if somebody else did that to you. That's terrible. That's not the
right.
In Capistan, we wouldn't have something like that. But I don't think it'll be as insidious, you know? Like, that's some sick stuff. Like, just to have, like, a fake car sitting there, and it's just, it's stealing your money, man. Like, that's all it's doing. Just for you going 5 miles over the speed limit.
Well, that's, all the government, that's all the government does, right?
It's unreal. It's unreal.
Well, hey, let's bring it back to Selma a little bit. One of the funny things I saw in it towards the end was when LBJ said to King that he's sick and tired of being told what he can and cannot do. And I thought that was a delicious irony because that's pretty much what the president does, what government does.
What they can and cannot do, yeah.
Yeah. LBJ was a trip, man. I mean, I read a little about him. I watched, like, there was another movie that came out on HBO with Bill Cranston. He played LBJ.
Mm.
I mean, he was interesting, you know, because, I mean, for every other aspect, he was a racist guy, you know. I mean, maybe not racist, but prejudice at least, you know. I read a book by his driver. He had a black driver that drove for him, and he would just call him the N-word all day, just nonstop. N-word, give me this. You know, nigga, give me that, you know. So it was, I mean, if we, you know, if people knew that part about him, you know, maybe they would think different of him, or they just ignore it now. But, you know, he was obviously a Democrat and just a kind of a finger in the wind politician that, you know, hey, I'm just going to do whatever that'll give me the best legacy and it'll keep me going, you know.
Yep.
He was always interesting to me.
Yeah, they don't got no principles.
None whatsoever. Like, he literally had no principles. It was just like, yeah, whatever works best today, you know.
Well, he's actually, you know, he's pretty famous. I know one of my teachers back in high school, it's actually his favorite president, and all because of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And for some reason, I mean, everybody seems to like it, especially lefties and whatnot, really love the Civil Rights Act. But this is what it does. It outlawed discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And on the face, you go, well, people shouldn't discriminate based on that. But doesn't this really get into thought crime where somebody doesn't hire somebody, and you go, well, why didn't you hire somebody? It's like, well, I had my reasons. Well, what are those reasons? Well, and you're going to evaluate him on his reasons, and you're going to judge him for his reasons, whether or not he wants to associate with somebody or not. It really seems like the thought police on whether or not you decided of how or why to hire somebody or to hang out with somebody and how you're not allowed to do that. From a libertarian point of view, I think people have a reason, you know, a right to associate or not associate with whoever they want. If they want to hire all white people or all people named Robert, and that's fine. You're cutting yourself off from a potential labor pool of better candidates. But if that's what you want to do, I don't have the right to tell you not to do it. I don't have a right to stick a gun in your face and make you not do it. So, for me, the Civil Rights Act is horrible, but anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, when you look at it, you know, I mean, it was the start of, I mean, I won't say it was the start, but it was a big impetus of government invasion into private business, private lives, and, you know, deciding what's right and what's wrong and how you live, you know, and that's basically what it led to, you know, because, sure, you could say, you know, hey, you shouldn't discriminate on hiring anybody, but how do you decide who's discriminating, you know? If I come to your business and you have 19 white people working and one black, you know, that means I have to come in and say, no, you need three more black people, or you need three more minorities. And that was funny. That was the thing. It didn't specifically say black people. It just meant, you know, race, sex, religion, this and that. So they kind of softened the tone a little bit right there. But, yeah, that's basically what they're saying. And, I mean, when you look at it, it's just not right. But, you know, I mean, I read in some places, even down south, there was already a movement to end these, you know, public accommodation businesses like restaurants and such, to where they allowed, you know, they allowed black people. They took down the color-only signs. I mean, they pulled down the white-only signs. And that was happening, you know, slowly, you know, but not fast enough for, you know, the civil rights groups, you know. But even after they passed that, you could still, if you had a restaurant or a public accommodations type of business, you could still discriminate, but you had to change, like, the status of your business to, like, a private club. So even down south in Mississippi and Louisiana, you had these restaurants that became private clubs, and you'd have to get on, like, some kind of membership list. And it lasted for a couple of years, but eventually it just died because, you know, they weren't making any money, you know, because people it just didn't work.
You're not getting all your possible clientele, man.
Exactly. I mean, so this guy here next door, he's taking whites, blacks, Hispanics, everybody. He's making tons of dough. Meanwhile, you have a membership list of whites only, you know, a safe space. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you're broke, you know. So, you know, the economic laws always come into play. And I think eventually economic laws would have came into play, you know, if you know, blacks and other minority groups would have grown in, you know, in economic impact, you know, I think you would have saw those things change. But, you know, some people want things quicker, you know, they're not willing to wait, you know.
Yeah, I'm a little bit torn because the whole movie is they're begging the government to change the laws. And, you know, the Jim Crow laws were government laws. Slavery was government laws. And as much as, you know, I have a distaste as a libertarian anarchist for the Civil Rights Act, like Robert was saying, you know, it forces association, it does seem like the events that occurred on a social level needed to occur to make some impact in how people were treated. I mean, it does seem that there was a positive outcome as a result of it, not the laws, but, you know, that people are seen as being treated more equally, you know, not the equality of outcome, but equality of opportunity, which
I
can see in time.
Yeah, I mean, now we look at it like, hey, this would never happen. This outcome would have never happened without that happening. Maybe it would have. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Maybe we still would have been living in a segregated society. You know, I don't know. I can't answer that because we didn't get the chance to see. You know, so, I had the same struggle. Like, of all the libertarian issues, this was one of the ones. It took me a long time. You know, people would read Lou Rockwell, and he'd be like, no public accommodations. People need to be able to discriminate how they want. I kind of winced at it like, you know, that kind of sucks, man. I like to... You know, there's some restaurants I like to go to, you know. What if, you know, what if they had a whites-only sign, man? I couldn't enjoy that steak I like, you know. And, you know, you just kind of think like that. But then after I kind of just talking to people and just starting to wrap my mind around it, you start to kind of understand that, you know, it was the government pushing this issue, you know. If the government just got out of the way, even if you go back to Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, when the black kid from New Orleans, you know, he sat on the train, a whites-only train car, and he wanted to be seated in the whites-only area. Then he sued the train car company, and you know, the Supreme Court eventually passed. You know, they made some declaration of, you know, hey, separate but equal. You know, you can have what you want, you know, but you have to have it separate. You know, that was the government coming in to interfere. Let entrepreneurs figure that problem out. You know, maybe. If, you know, some white people want to have their own train car, they have to pay $5 extra, you know. Black people want to have their own train car, they have to pay. Maybe you have some white and blacks that, hey, they like to hang out together. They pay a certain price and let the market kind of figure it out. And eventually things kind of work this stuff out through the market, you know. So you're not going to get the perfect outcome all the time, but at least the people get to decide what they want, you know. I mean, I know there are some country clubs in America that are whites only. I could go and try to apply. They would say no, you know, and they have every right to do so, even under today's laws, you know. But that's okay, you know. There's nothing wrong with it. You know?
Yeah, and doesn't government action? I mean, you can't legislate human behavior through government action. Doesn't it? All it do is really just kind of make it hidden. So you're not going to get rid of racism by saying, oh, racism is now illegal. You're just kind of hiding it so that whites only sign gets put away, and then the black guy goes in the restaurant, and then they're spitting in his food. But he didn't know that there were a bunch of racists in there. Wouldn't have been better if that sign had still been out front.
Right. I've always said this, even before I was a libertarian. I'm like, I like to know who the racists are. You know, I would rather know who to give my money to, you know.
Yeah.
Why would I want to go to a business that literally doesn't want me in there? You know, why would I give him money? But, you know, I talked to some people, you know, I used to go back and forth with this. You know, I used to talk to my mom. She would talk about how she had to walk like miles to get to the store that allowed black people to shop there. You know, meanwhile, And literally right around the block, there was a store where only white people could go. And, you know, he just always would drive her crazy because her mom would ask her, I need you to run to the store to go buy so-and-so and buy some bread. And she just knew she had to walk like 6 miles knowing there's a store right there, you know, to get what she needs. So, I mean, I could understand their mind frame back then, like, oh, this sucks. Like, this is what's, you know, why can't we just go to this store right here? You know, why can't they just look at us as humans? We just want to eat just like everyone else.
Right.
You know, so I understand it, you know. I get it. But when you're dealing with people, you're dealing with human beings, man, you can't get the outcomes you want instantly. You know, only government tries to create that. And even then, that outcome, you know, that outcome comes with caveats. You know, and, yeah, you might get what you want, but there's a cost. There's always a cost, you know.
It makes me think there was something holding that together. And I got to think it was government. I mean, like you were saying, the economics of it would lead people to compete for customers. And, you know, if you're going to self-restrict your clientele, you're going to put yourself at a disadvantage.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I guess, you know, if in some areas, if it was, if you got a real small, you know, black population, you know, there probably wouldn't have been much of an economic difference if you allowed them a night. You know, maybe, you know, their clientele just didn't want to be bothered with, you know, people, you know, different races, you know, so, you know, maybe it made economic sense for them, but it also opened up opportunities. You know, maybe another store comes in and say, hey, I move closer, I see an opportunity here. You know, there's no store within 6 miles. I can put my store right here and sell to blacks and whites, you know?
Yeah.
And hey, it makes money, you know? It's just not the quick solution we've come accustomed to looking for, you know, and only the government comes in and, you know, snaps their fingers and uses a gun to force those solutions.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, and the irony of affirmative action, which was it a part of the Civil Rights Act or was it something that came a little bit later? But it, in an effort to eliminate racism, it actually introduces race as a deciding factor.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a part of the Civil Rights Act. Maybe part of it was, but it's kind of been bubbling. It was kind of bubbling through every like presidential cabinet or whatever, you know. But eventually, I think it really grew in the 70s. You know, of Nixon, like Nixon, people like to talk about LBJ, but Nixon like expanded all the bad stuff. Like he expanded Great Society, the war on the poor, the war on drugs, you know, affirmative action, all that stuff. He blew all that up, you know.
Yeah, and he came in on all of these free market ideas, right? That was his rhetoric. He comes in with price controls and devalues the dollar, all the stuff you were just saying. Like he's terrible. Just terrible.
He's awful, man. I mean, he came in on like the whole Southern strategy. He was like, you know, hey, I'm a, you know, these angry whites down south, I'm going to try to use them to get me, you know, get some votes out of them, you know, and he said the right things, you know, and he just, you know, I don't know, he just did every bad thing imaginable he did. I guess the only good thing he did was kind of like normalize relations with China, you know, and pulled out of Vietnam. Well, I don't even know if I don't know if you could give him credit for pulling out of Vietnam, but, yeah, I mean, he was terrible in every aspect.
Yeah, I give the Vietnamese credit for that. Weren't the Americans, like, trying to get the hell out?
Yeah. But you know how that goes. You could have had a guy in there that would just double down, like just or nuke him or something like that, you know.
I just want to add a little more controversy to the show. We need some more listeners.
Nah, man, but affirmative action, like that's one of the things. Even before I was a libertarian, when I was just a normal Democrat, it just never sat right with me. You know, it's just wrong. I mean, like, everything about it is just wrong. Like at the end of the day, you know, you should be, you know, hired or, you know, granted, you know, admission because of your, you know, because of how good you do, because of your merits, you know, period, you know. If somebody wants to give you an opportunity and they think you're a sympathy case, you know, that's fine, but don't make that a law, you know, don't make that the law of the land, you know, which is, it is terrible, and it has so many other disastrous effects. I know me personally, when I started my first job when I got out of school, I was working for the Army. As a contractor, and you know there was one guy there that kind of thought I got hired through affirmative action or whatever. I wound up finding out, like, oh, he's one of those token guys. This guy, but it was, you know, it was a majority black base that I was working at, but it really wasn't. And it was funny because when I talked to my boss, he actually thought I was white when he hired me because we interviewed over the phone. He was like, hey man, you know, I thought you was a white guy. And I was like, oh, I thought you were white too. And he was like. You know, it was all good. You know, I never did fill out that section on applications. You know, the EOE section where you got to identify yourself. Like, I would never fill that part out. I always thought, like, man, if you're gonna hire me because you want me. Hire me because my resume is good and I give a real good interview. You know, I don't want to work anywhere where I'm just kind of giving, because I'm always going to be looking in the back, you know, looking behind myself, wondering like, wow, when am I going to get fired? You know, because if I wasn't good enough to get in, how am I good enough to maintain this job? You know, and I think a lot of people deal with that. A lot of, you know, minorities and or even women. You know, women use affirmative action a lot. You know, I think that ends up putting them in situations where they can't win. You know.
Yeah, and we'll do the pay gap on another show, but it's spoiler alert, bullshit. No, that's great. I think who was it? Who was a professor who was assigning a book for people to read, and they would come back and argue like this author's racist and terrible and all this shit, and come to find out it's Thomas Sowell and he's a black guy.
I think that was Tom Woods. I'm not sure. I think that was a Tom Woods story. I think could have been someone else.
Yeah, it always comes down to identity, right? Like, you know, who said it? Oh, well, you know, if you're white, you can't know about the black experience or the, you know, what have you experience. And I don't like that argument, you know. I mean, I think there is a nugget of truth to it. Like, obviously, I'm not living as, you know, whatever that situation is, whatever I'm talking about. But I am a human being, and I have a capacity to learn and understand, and I can see reason and logic. And, you know, so just to discount it because I'm not, you know, of a particular race or in a particular situation personally doesn't mean I can't have a conversation about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I don't know if everybody has that ability. You know, I've always tried to put myself in other people's shoes. You know, always. You know, it's no matter what the situation was. Why I always try to say, why would they make that decision? You know, and I'll try to understand it from their point of view. You know, and sometimes you can't explain it. Sometimes it makes no sense. But at least try to look at it from their point of view. You know, so I look at something like a friend of a. Affirmative action, I just imagine myself, you know, you work hard, you get, you know, 4.0 GPA, you get all your scores in order, you're ready to go to college, but nope, you can't get in, buddy. You know, why? You know, we found somebody else, you know, they didn't do as good as you, but hey, sucks, man, you know, go to community college, you know, find somewhere else to go. You know, I mean, that would crush me, you know, that crushes a lot of people, you know, and that creates resentment, you know, and that creates, you know, these racial, you know, racism, it creates racism, prejudice, you know, it creates all these, you know, all these feelings and resentments in people that lead to, you know, a Donald Trump being president or somebody like that, you know?
But, yeah, I mean, that's politics in general, man. It's divisive. It cuts people out into little groups and pits them against other groups, all for their political gain.
Right, because who complains the most to the government gets the grease. And all they do is take from one group and give to another. So, yeah, it's built in to create resentment.
Dividing and conquer, it works. You know, it works. The government loves it. You know, they love, that's why the left is pushing this whole SJW, you know, breaking down everybody into these gender roles and 100 gender pronouns. And they want to break it down as far as they can, you know, to get all of these little groups on their side, you know, because it only helps them. You know, it only helps the states. Meanwhile, Republicans, you know, the Republicans used to do the same thing, you know. You know, you had all your little, you know, right-wing groups that they would try to promote. I mean, they did it at a lesser extent. I think identity politics is mostly a left-wing thing, but I think in general it's a government thing. Like, it's a state thing. The state likes identity politics, you know.
Yeah. You know, I think the Trump phenomenon is a situation where they went too far and they made everyone else not in one of these little special snowflake groups be this other giant group, like the deplorables, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it made, like, all these little factions of leftist groups, and they were all divided, you know, like Bernie fans and then women who liked Hillary for whatever reason, and there was a lot of infighting there, so there was separation, but then they labeled everyone who was against both Bernie and Hillary as evil and deplorable and stupid and Neanderthal and racist and whatever, I mean, you name it. And it's... You know, it's what brought them all together, right? It was a common enemy. Like, this mass of groups was the enemy to, you know, because I think that a lot of people who voted Trump were feeling attacked in a way. And I don't mean it in a physical sense. I mean it in a talk shit about sense.
I mean, I watched it, man. I just watched it on social media. Like, if you said not even something nice about Trump, if you just said, oh, he's not too bad here, you know, he's not too bad on this issue, it's like, oh, what the fuck? You know, what the hell are you talking about? Like, wow, like, where are we? You know, where are we, you know, in society today? It's kind of scary, you know, but that's where we are. You know, you just, I can't even explain it. I, you know, I don't, I'm not a Trump lover. I'm just like, hey, I think he's just a creature of today. You know, he's a creature. He's where we are today, and as the United States, and as you know, people trying to figure this out, this whole identity thing. You know, economics. I really do think it all comes down to economics. I really do think, you know, past 8 years after the recession, I think people are hurting worse than the news is saying. I think there's a large segment. I mean, I was looking at some stats the other day. Something like 40% of blacks are on some type of government assistance month to month. I mean, 40%. Like, that's just unreal, man. I mean, almost half the, like, 40 million people are on food stamps. I mean, people in the United States are on food stamps. And it's just unreal, man. I mean, people either are hurting and they're living off the government and they don't know what the government is doing. Are they doing enough or they're doing too little. You know, I think people are just frustrated and they're just looking for answers, you know. They'll vote for anybody at this point. Just say something that, you know, makes me feel better today. I'll vote for you, you know.
Yeah, and Trump was, of the two candidates, he was the change candidate, regardless of all his flaws. And obviously,
no,
I'm not a fan, but he was absolutely a rebuttal to 8 years of Obama.
Absolutely. Like, he's the opposite, you know. It's just funny to me. I just was happy to see Clinton go, man. I mean, I just couldn't stand her so much. It was just nice to see her just lose in flaming fashion like that, you know.
Wasn't it glorious?
Like, she didn't even say anything after that. Like, I remember that night she sent, what's his name, Podesta, sent him out. Like, hey, we're going to talk about this in the morning. Y'all can go home. Like, that was it. That was her. I just imagine her, like, in the back just, I don't know, crying or just staring at the wall in the mirror or something. Having an epilepsy attack or something. I don't know.
She didn't have a concession speech written out, for sure.
No. At all.
No, none of those people thought that she was going to lose. It was a big shock.
Yeah.
And it was a huge rejection. Like, how could so many people vote for Trump? They must all be, I can't believe America's just full of racist, bigot, homophobes.
Man, listen, I have my personal Twitter account. I mostly follow, like, mutual sports fans and football fans and stuff like that. And most of them are apolitical, but they lean left. And just the stuff I see on my timeline, is I just get tired of it. Racist, how can you support a racist, a white supremacist? I'm like, dude, do you know what a white supremacist is, man? Like, do you really know what a white supremacist is? A guy that shaves his head, has, like, this big swastika tattoo on his chest, you know, that's trying to kill blacks and Jews. Like, that's a white supremacist. You know, some guy is against affirmative action and, you know, and says, hey, white people aren't too bad. He's a white supremacist. You know?
Right.
It's just ridiculous at this point. Like, I don't even like. I used to like, you know, arguing and debating those people. I just can't even do it anymore because when you debate them, you're debating at their level, and you can't win at their level, you know, unless you go the alt-right route, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not alt-right, but that's why I understand where the alt-right comes from, because if you want to debate them at their level, you got to get down in the dirt with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I almost consider them not worth converting at this point, you know? Like, they're not going to listen to reason. They're not going to listen to a philosophical argument. They're kind of a lost cause.
Lost cause, man.
Yeah, so, hey, I have one last thing on Selma before we can start to wind this down. It feels like we've been on for quite a while. Not to, you know, disrespect you at all, Ryan. This is late for me, and I know it's later for you. You've been a great guest, by the way, so I really appreciate you coming on. You gave Liam a run for his money. He was our other guest.
Oh, cool.
But towards the end of the film, LBJ has George Wallace in the White House, and he's saying, hey, it's your state, it's your responsibility, it's your problem. And I thought that was kind of a nod to a states' rights thing, which I think was more of an issue back then. And, you know, if we're going to talk about a spectrum of politics, I think that I would prefer to have states have more power than the federal government. Granted, neither one's legitimate in my mind. But there was a point where, you know, LBJ is like berating him about this, saying it's your problem. But then Wallace chides back at him, like, oh, well, you want to distribute wealth or redistribute wealth, kind of like cut back at LBJ. And I thought that was kind of interesting because it was, I think, presented in the film to connote George Wallace being this, you know, evil racist politician and the distribution of wealth and that idea, kind of painting it in a bad light, in a negative light. So that was the one political message that I was able to divine from this outside of the story, in that they were trying to sort of conflate him with a negative view of a redistribution of wealth, like saying that a racist wouldn't want to redistribute wealth, but a normal, reasonable person is totally fine with it.
Right. No, it's true. You know, it's true. And that's how the left has tried to portray it for the longest. You know, they view capitalism as the racist ideology and distribution of wealth and socialism as a egalitarian, equality type of ideology, you know. Hey, can I pause for 1 second? I'm on mute. I need to go run and handle it. I'll be 1 minute.
Sure.
All right, I'll be right
back. Man, no problem. We got plenty to say about you now, man.
All right, go ahead.
Can you believe that guy? No, just kidding.
I think he's been an awesome guest, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But to his point, yeah, capitalism is constantly being painted as the, not only as the tool of the oppressor, but as the uncaring, whereas the redistribution is the compassionate thing. Never mind the fact, they always look at the end of it. They never look at the beginning of it. Like, where did you get the money to begin with? Oh, with a gun in somebody's face. Oh, yeah, but we just have this money. It's just there. I mean, it's just, that's just the system. That's just what it's there for. So why not just distribute it?
Yeah. Right, and they miss, like, where the person who had the money got the money. You know, they provided a service. That somebody wanted. And so then they earned a profit out of that. So if anything, the person providing that service actually bettered another person's life already, and then has the hand of government come in, shove a gun in their face and say, well, now we want you to do something better for someone else in our estimation, and by the way, we're going to take a huge cut of it in bureaucracy and other bullshit and dribble out a couple of crumbs out to the people that were, you know, marketing-wise, like, appearing to help.
Right, and is altruism at the point of a gun altruism at all? I would say no.
No, it is.
Yeah, so...
Yeah,
true charity is only comes from when you have the wealth to provide it. So if you're just stealing everybody's money and at the point of a gun and then redistributing it, that's not charity, that's not altruism. That's just theft and redistribution. But when you actually have the money, you don't get all your money stolen from you. You're far more likely to help out somebody that's in need.
Yeah, I remember in one of the lectures in the Austrian economics course from the Mises Institute, they talk about how the Red Cross, I think, was offered $1 million back in the 1920s from the federal government. And they said no. They're like, hey, if everyone hears that you gave us $1 million, they're going to stop donating to us. And we'll get far more from people just normally. But if they think that you've given us $1 million, they're not going to give us money. You know,
right, so because of the situation would have been taken care of in their eyes.
Right, which is kind of how government portrays itself, as taking care of all these situations, and of course they're inept about it. So I think that as much charity as does exist today, even with all this taxation and all these government programs that proclaim to be helping the needy and the homeless and less fortunate, Americans are still by far and away, I believe this is the statistic, giving more than any other country or society in the world. And just imagine if they didn't think that it was already being taken care of with money that was already being taken from them, like how much more giving people would be.
And if they had that 30 or 40% more of their income.
Exactly.
To be generous with.
Yeah, so I think we filled that time while you were gone, Ryan.
Yeah, good time.
So I don't want to leave the show without mentioning Morgan Freeman. Ryan, you and I talked about him briefly on the call the other day, and he was on 60 Minutes probably 15 years ago now, and they were asking him about Black History Month and how he would want to deal with racism. And he said, well, how would you feel about if there was a white month? You know, which month is white month? And he said, well, I'm Jewish. The interviewer guy said, all right, which month is Jewish month? And the guy shot back, well, you know, how do you want to deal with racism? And Morgan Freeman, like a boss, says, stop talking about it. You know, stop making a big deal about it. We're just people. We're just individuals, you know. That Morgan Freeman guy, I can get behind him, too. He's awesome.
Yeah, I remember that. No, that was great. A lot of, and if you post that clip now, that clip has been posted like on Twitter, and like the, you know, the Black Lives Matter folks and the SJWs and all those guys, they can't stand it. They're like, oh, that coon, that Uncle Tom, living in Hollywood too long, blah 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 blah. You know, so you know.
Well, they can't stand racism not being the narrative. They view the world in like this, whether somebody's racist or not, prism.
Yeah. They know
they like to put people in boxes of, oh, this person's obviously a racist because he voted for Trump or whatever.
They think they know racism better than Morgan Freeman, who grew up in, you know, southern part of Mississippi. You know, was born, like, I don't know when he was born. He seems like he's been old as hell forever.
Right.
But he, you know, he came up and he probably dealt with all kinds of crap. You know, he had to fight his way. He didn't get into movies until like late in his career because he had to work through the whole circuit, you know, Broadway. But yeah, they know more about racism than him. You know, and that's
right.
One thing that always drives me crazy, especially with the younger generation, not to get on the whole, you know. Oh, those darn millennials. I'm not trying to do that, but, you know, they think they know it all, of course. And they think
right.
they know, like, they have no idea how they would have dealt with what their fathers and grandfathers went through back in the day. You know, I mean, people really dealt with crap, you know. And you're sitting here crying because somebody doesn't agree with a political view, you know.
So that they need a safe space. And, yeah, it's ridiculous. They are the cupcake generation, no doubt.
It's unbelievable, you know. These people got spit in the face. They got, you know, kicked, punched, sprayed with water hoses, you know, ran out of town. Towns were burned down, you know. These things happened, and they had to live with that, you know. And that's all. It's almost like a spit in the face to that generation. Say what you want about that generation and what came out of it, be it, you know, the civil rights era and stuff like that. But that, you know, that took guts to do that stuff back then, you know. I don't know if I'd have had the guts. Because most black people didn't take part in the civil rights organizations and stuff like that. I talked to my mom. Ask her about, like, you know, how she dealt with racism back then. She's like, she really didn't see it. You know, I mean, she just, you know, black people stayed on their side of town, white people stayed on theirs, and you just kind of lived life. You really wasn't really exposed to it until you got older and, you know, you started going out in the world a little more, you know? And, you know, I mean, so most people back then, you know, even they were kind of separated from you. People figure out how to live their lives, you know? And just imagine if the state just got out the way, you know? Imagine the, you know, the potential lying, you know, within us, you know?
Yeah, if they just get out the way. Yeah, that's one thing that the movie really, I thought, came across really well, was just how intelligent and brave MLK was. He really did. He was standing up against, you know, the biggest group of violent thugs in the world. So it's no small feat what he did.
No, not at all, man. I enjoy it. I mean, those guys... You know, I think he's a very important figure in history. Like him or not, he made a major impact, man. I mean, he really shook it up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, as a libertarian, you know, you can look at him how you want. But he's somebody you have to talk about, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so Ryan, before we wind this down, I want to ask about, there's a controversy between Trump and John Lewis, who was actually in the march with MLK at Selma. And now is he a congressman or a senator? I don't recall.
Congressman.
Congressman, yeah. And Trump was saying that, you know, his district is in bad shape and he's all talk, no action, because he was, Lewis was saying that he believed the Russian hacking makes Trump an illegitimate president. I mean,
yeah.
I agree he's an illegitimate president, but I have nothing to do with hacking. Any president would have been illegitimate in my mind. But all these people are rushing to Lewis's defense by saying, oh, you know, it's MLK Day and he was this great black activist and all those things. And sure, that's fine, I agree. But it doesn't make him right.
It's just typical liberal response, you know. I mean, Lewis literally tells the incoming president, you know, you're illegitimate. Which, I mean, think about that. Really, think of where we're at now. I mean, usually at this point, even the opposition is, you know, at least viewing the incoming president as legitimate. You know, they're not super disrespectful. They're just like, oh, we're going to work with the incoming president, and we're going to try to get what we need for our people and our constituents. You know, that's usually the way. But now it's just like, I mean, it's just crazy, you know. And so, okay, I mean, Lewis knew what Trump's response would be, you know. He knew he would get a response. And liberals respond back, oh, no, don't go hard on him. He marched with Martin Luther King, and he was in the dirt fighting. He was getting punched on the bridge, you know. Like, yeah, now you want to bring that up, you know.
Mm.
It's media crap, you know. I don't think I've even made a comment on it since all that's been going on, because it's just stupid to me. You know, man, it's like, you know, where are we going here? You know, but it's using it as another example of, hey, look, Trump's a racist. You know?
Right, and Trump's not even talking about his civil rights activities. He's talking about, you know, hey, you're calling me illegitimate, and you know, wherever you represent in Georgia is like in bad shape, or you know, whatever. Like,
it's been for years, like decades. You know, but
he's
always held, because he will always hold that he has the cushiest job in the world. You know, I mean, he gets voted in every year just because every year he comes out, every time it's time to run, he pulls out the old photographs of him sitting at the table with Martin Luther King and walking down down the bridge with Martin Luther King. Hey, I was right there with him. So he pulls that card every time, but he's done nothing. You know, he's done nothing for, you know, for black people or anybody for that matter, you know.
Yeah, I haven't heard much about him other than this and when he did the sit-in at the floor of Congress about gun control.
Oh, you remember that? It looked so stupid.
Yeah. And then they were trying to play it off like it was like a hunger strike kind of deal, but then there were some behind-the-scenes like photos that people got, and they had catered sandwiches or something. It was ridiculous.
So stupid, man. Like, you're a little too old for that, not buddy. You know? But those, like, those people, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, like, those are, you know, the whole race thing was a cottage industry for them, you know. Because after the civil rights thing, you know, it was like, okay, now what? You know, we're not skilled in anything else. You know,
right.
So they created careers, you know, in race baiting and racial issues. You know, I remember when you guys remember the Jenna Six thing? You remember
Jenna Six?
Yeah, it was like these black kids in high school down here in Louisiana. And then some white kid hung up a noose or something in like the lunchroom, and they got in a fight with the black kids, and then the black kid got charged with attempted murder because he punched a white kid or something. It was a big thing some years ago, but this is one of those little media frenzies.
It sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I mean, nobody talks about it now because the kid that punched the white kid, he eventually started. They dropped the charges eventually about, you know, the attempted murder charges. But he still got in trouble later. He was, like, robbing people. You know, he wound up becoming just another thug. So nobody likes to bring that up anymore. But anyway, I remember there was this big march in Jenna, Louisiana. You know, and I knew a lot of people that went down there. This was way before I was a libertarian. I was all into it. I was like, yeah, Jenna 6. You know, we can't have people hanging nooses at school, you know, stuff like that. I was into all of that. And I remember a lot of people that went down there, Al Sharpton was there. And they said Al Sharpton was charging people $50 take a picture with him. Like, all these people that went down there to march with him, he's charging them to take a picture with him. You know, and everybody was like, man, he is a piece of shit. Nobody likes him. Like, literally nobody. And everybody, I mean, people, I see, like, the alt-right and, you know, some conservatives like to say, oh, Al Sharpton, why do you black people look up to Al Sharpton? I'm telling you from a black person's perspective. Like, nobody likes Al Sharpton. Like, like, Democrats, I mean, there's a few, like, the old school guys, they love him. You know, but everybody know what he is. He's a capitalist, if you want to think about it. I mean, he just try to capitalize on race. That's what he does.
Yeah, like any kind of racial tragedy or anything, it seems like he was just like the outrage police.
I mean, he's there. If there's something that happens, you know, first thing he does, calls the family, you know, tries gender support with him, and, you know, he's coming down. He's coming down with the cameras. He's calling every news crew within 100 miles to make sure they're going to be on the step of the city hall at this time so they could watch him give a speech, and then he's out of town. You know.
He's got to sign his baseballs and sell them first, right?
Right. Ridiculous. And those people like that, they've made it worse. You know, these past 40 years, you know, they've made it worse, the whole racial, how we get along with each other, you know. Because individually, blacks and whites and Hispanics and Muslims and all that, we get along pretty well, no problem. But once you bring these whole collective attitudes into play, that's when things get dicey and our brains automatically trigger into tribalism mode, you know?
Right.
Where we gotta get with our guys, you know? I thought it was interesting. I was listening to Dave Smith from
Part of the Problem.
Yeah. I was listening to his episode, and he was talking about that white kid that got tortured in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
They had on video. He had mental disability. Just terrible, you know, terrible situation.
Right.
And even he said when he first saw the video, he had kind of a private reaction, like anger, like he started feeling like he was getting like kind of mad at blacks and, you know, screw them, you know, started getting that feeling, but then he had to kind of check himself and, you know, kind of come back to it. But that's like a human reaction, you know, for all of us, you know, and it's not always based on race. Sometimes it's based on class or, you know, what neighborhood we live in or who's your favorite football team or whatever, you know.
Right.
But it's kind of a human trait. But I think ultimately, you know, it serves us best to fight that feeling. Sometimes you got to embrace that feeling, depending, you know, what's going on, you know. But you know, we got to use our brains, these big brains that we've been blessed with. You know, we can think bigger than that. We could think bigger than an animal. You know, we've evolved further than that. You know.
Yeah, well, that's what brought us together, Ryan. Using those big brains, getting together on the libertarian scene.
Yes, sir.
Well, hey, why don't we wrap this up? Unless anyone has any last thoughts on the film or any of the other topics we've talked about. You got anything else there, Ryan?
Nah, man, I appreciate it. I appreciate you guys welcoming me on. I've done like sports podcasts before, but I've never done any political or libertarian podcast. So it's a cool experience, just shooting the shit with you guys. So I'll definitely be checking you guys out moving forward, and I'll try to promote you where I can. I'm just not like I'm some kind of big shot, but man, just keep up the good work, man. Spreading the message, talking about liberty, talking about Rothbard, talking about anarchism. It's a long route. We have to take the long view. It's gonna be long time until we get what we want, but hey, let's just things we're doing right now will make an impact, even if it's just one person listening. It's going to make some kind of impact, I truly believe, anyway.
Well, thank you for saying that, Ryan. Sometimes I think we might only have one person listening, but I do take that there is a lesson in this film, and it is that we got to take the long view, even if we have the moral right to defend ourselves. Maybe maybe strategically it's not the best thing to do in that particular case. And I'm not saying that specifically that's what we should do, but I'm taking the concept of, hey, maybe the immediate right thing to do isn't the best thing to do. And so I think there's something to be said for that.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
All right. Well, hey, you guys who want to see more from Ryan, you can see his blog at the AfroLibertarian.com. It's with the, right? Yeah,
yeah.
TheAfroLibertarian.com.
You can also follow me on Twitter at AfroLibertarian.com. Try to post as much as I can. I don't post every day, but usually when I do post, I start ranting for a while. So give me a holler there. Yeah.
All right, and Ryan, you're welcome to post this show if after you listen to it and you're not too ashamed of being on the show with us. Feel free to post it on your blog or on Twitter.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, hey, I want to thank our guests for joining us, and just reiterate what we said at the opening of the show. This is the last Reed Rothbard podcast where we're going to be doing this format under this name. We're going to be transitioning over to the actual Anarchy podcast, where we're going to take Robert and I talking about films and libertarian themes, where there's examples of anarchy happening in everyday situations. We are going to continue on with ReedRothbard.com. We're going to post more of Rothbard's lectures and books. We're going to continue with The Enemy of the State, which has his lectures, and we're going to be launching actualanarchy.com in the coming weeks. So we're going to take a little bit of a hiatus in preparation, so look for us coming out with Actual Anarchy Podcast and actualanarchy.com. In the meantime, continue to check out readrothbard.com, click any of the Amazon links, Liberty Classroom links, readit4.me links, or our Patreon page, YouTube, Twitter, BuzzFeed. Oh, no, that's not an actual thing. That's fake news. Anyway, you get the idea. Send us a smoke signal, whatever you got. Robert, you got anything else you want to add to this?
Nope. I am learning my ukulele and don't anticipate anything spectacular anytime soon. My big fat fingers just don't work super good on that tiny little thing, but it was a good idea, and I will have something at some time, probably, maybe.
All right. Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, Robert and I used to talk about a book that he's working on in the progress, at least in the first dozen or so episodes of our podcast. And in one of his updates, he said that he was going to write a song to do a promotion with a ukulele. And then for Christmas, I got him one, and we posted that video on YouTube just last night. So now he has a positive obligation to follow through on what he said he was going to do. And so hopefully, this will push him along in that path, and we'll be able to hear more about his book and the song on the Actual Anarchy podcast in coming weeks. So I thank you guys for joining us. I thank Ryan for joining us. You can find more about him at theafrolibertarian.com. So this is Daniel signing off from the Reed Rothbard podcast. You'll find us again in a couple of weeks on the Actual Anarchy podcast. So thank you very much, folks, and good night from me.
Take care, everybody. The chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.